Hi, this is David Spray from the IC Disc Show. I just had a great interview with John Flatowitz, former managing partner of Briggs & Veselka, the largest independent CPA firm in Houston, Texas. In particular, it was interesting hearing about when John joined Briggs & Veselka to start the audit practice at the ripe old age of 26 years old, and the philosophies that he had then that he still has today and that the firm has today. The firm grew from 9 people in 1982 to over 300 people now. So it's an interesting story of how you grow a CPA firm and a lot of other client service lessons from there. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did.
Hi, John.
Hello, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good. And how are you today?
Doing good.
That's excellent. So let me go ahead and get started. My guest today is John Flatowitz, the former managing shareholder at the CPA firm of Briggs & Veselka, the largest independent CPA firm in Houston. Is that correct, John?
That's correct.
Okay. So with that, why don't we get started? What I'd first like to do is I like to give our listeners just some context for our guests. And so you, I believe you grew up in Nebraska. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Omaha or a suburb of Omaha, I believe.
I actually grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and pretty much stayed there until I left to go to graduate school in Austin, Texas in my early 20s.
Okay, so I guess you went undergraduate then somewhere besides UT?
Yes, I attended University of Nebraska for undergraduate school where I got my accounting degree, and then I went to University of Texas in Austin to get a master's in accounting.
Okay, I did not realize that you have an undergraduate degree from Nebraska, and that's UNL, right, in Lincoln?
Yes.
Or were you in Omaha? Okay. Excellent. And so then when you graduated from UT, I guess that's what brought you to Houston?
Yes. At the time, of course, everybody wants to stay in Austin. Beautiful.
Sure.
City in Austin.
Yeah.
The jobs were all pretty much in Houston. At that time, there were the big eight accounting firms, not the big four as they are now, and heavily recruited UT's master's in accounting graduates. And decided to come to Houston and followed several friends that went to Arthur Young & Company in Houston.
Okay. And then they subsequently merged with Ernst and Winnie, I believe.
That's correct.
To form Ernst & Young.
That's correct.
Okay. And I also believe that, is my understanding correct that you are a first-generation American? Is that what it means, that you were the first in your family born in the U.S.?
Yes. My dad was originally from Poland. My mom was from Paris. And my two older siblings, my older brother Pierre, older sister Martine, were born in Paris. My next oldest brother, Frank, was actually born on the ship coming over here. And I was the first one born actually in the United States, along with my younger brother, Glenn.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. Just for the record, I used to work at Briggs & Veselka, and John was my primary boss. So I thought I knew a lot about your background, but it turns out that there's a lot I didn't know. So, well, congratulations on being the first in your family to be born in the U.S.
Thank you.
So you came to Houston to go to work for Arthur Young, and so I guess, did you start in the audit practice?
Yeah, when I was at Arthur Young, I was started in their audit practice side and spent about a little under 4 years there.
Okay, and what year did you start there?
I think it was 1978.
Okay, so you're there from 78 to 82.
That's correct.
And then what made you leave Arthur Young? What made you decide to leave?
I was with Arthur Young, like you said, about little under four years out of college. I learned a great deal there, being with a international big eight accounting firm. However, it was large. It was a large firm. I worked way too many hours and didn't really have strong relationships with both my clients and fellow employees. That weren't great because we never saw each other, always on jobs. And I kind of, at the time, I wanted to go to a firm where I could make some kind of immediate impact, where I'd know everybody. And coincidentally, at the same time, Briggs & Maselka was a small tax firm looking to start an audit practice to become a full service firm. And so it was the picture perfect time. And so I learned of it and interviewed and got the job and started the audit practice at Briggs & Maselka.
That's exciting, because at that time, after 4 years at Arthur Young, had you even been promoted to manager, or were you just recently?
I was getting ready to be, but I was not. And, to be honest, it was a little scary, because coming to Briggs & Maselka, at a large Big Eight accounting firm, they have so many levels of supervision that you don't learn the whole picture right away or as quickly as you would as a firm at Briggs & Maselka. So, yeah, there was a lot I didn't know, but, my nature is to I love challenges, and that was a great challenge. And I could honestly say there was no one at Briggs & Maselka that knew any more than I did about audit. So that made it
sure.
A very
sure. When you look back on your, so you were probably about, 27 or 28 at the time?
That's about 26, yes.
About 26, okay. So when you look back, are you like kind of scared for your younger self in hindsight, realizing just what a big challenge it was?
Yeah, I was. And although at that time, I didn't really have a concept of liability. I was 26 and, just anxious to grow things and make things happen.
Sure.
And all these years later, I am more conscious of that. So yes, I was scared.
Understood. And so when you joined the firm, how many people were at the firm when you joined?
We had either 8, 9, or 10. I'd say around 9 people at the time.
Okay. And the firm started, what year did Briggs & Maselka start?
Briggs & Maselka officially started in 1973.
Okay, so they'd been in business nearly a decade, 9 years or so. And I guess Johnny Maselka and Mel Briggs decided that they wanted to start an audit practice.
Yeah, they were pretty much a tax practice, and they got together and decided they wanted to be a full service accounting practice. And in those days, audit and tax were the two main practices you had to have to be a full service practice.
Sure, sure. And what was it about the opportunity at Briggs & Maselka that was attractive? Because, obviously with 4 years under your belt at a Big Eight firm, you would have had a lot of opportunities if you wanted to leave, right? You could have gone in-house, in internal audit or as a controller, or you could have gone to, a smaller CPA firm that had an audit practice already. So what were the elements that made Briggs & Maselka attractive?
Well, like I was saying earlier, the thing that was really attractive to me is they didn't have an audit practice, and it was a chance to start something up and build it from scratch. Not saying I knew how to do it then, but it was attractive because they were committed to being a quality firm. If you've met Johnny Maselka, tremendous integrity, great reputation in the city, and I had an opportunity about kind of a lifetime to start an audit practice for a quality firm, and especially at my age. And so I just looked at it as, someone was looking out for me. And I looked forward to it. I'm not saying it was always easy, but through the years, built up the audit practice to what it is today.
That is a great story. So I guess in summary, there was only one opportunity to start an audit practice from scratch, And then it sounds like the icing on the cake then was just your respect for Johnny and just the sense of connection you felt with the other people. It just, it felt like a comfortable place to be.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you know, if I look back on it now, Johnny was a tremendous influence when I interviewed with him. Interviewed with Johnny Vasulka and Steve AWOL, and I got a sense after that interview that they were down-to-earth, humble, despite having great reputations. And again, with the culture that they had, the opportunity they said they would help me grow, how fast I wanted to grow, they'd help support it. And they said, you know, if you do well, you have a clear shot to make partner one day because you're starting a whole new practice. And all of those things combined were very attractive to me. And you have to remember, this was in the early 80s when the Houston economy and the was bad, the savings and loan debacle, the, a lot of real estate problems in the city. So I kind of looked at it as a gold mine, you know, and took advantage of it, and here we are.
That's awesome. And do you remember what year then that you made partner?
I think it was... I'm trying to think. I think it was approximately, I think it was in 1989.
Okay. Okay. And then, so at what point, do you remember at what point that the audit practice was as large as the tax practice? Did that take, was that a couple years or did that take a decade or was it, you know, 20 years?
I'd say from the, obviously from the time I got here in 1982, it was probably 15, 17 years. And, you know, primarily because for many years I was the, when I became partner in 89, I was the lone audit partner and probably at the time with five or six tax partners. So obviously, you know, the tax practice was going to grow faster, but at some point in time through the years, until we started doing lots of acquisitions, that was, the audit practice had caught up to the tax practice.
Okay, that is helpful. So, talk to me about your philosophy, of building the audit practice. What kind of people were you looking for? Just, you know, again, what was kind of your philosophy? Was it to be the cheapest audit in town? Was it to be the most expensive audit in town? Was it to, just talk to us about what your philosophy was.
That's easy for me. I mean, you know, my focus and philosophy, number one, has always got to be two things. It's got to be quality. You know, we have technical standards. The ICPA puts out generally accepted accounting principles and auditing standards, the SASs. And so, number one, you have to have quality. You have to know what you're doing. You have to study all the FASBs and SASs. That's number one. And the second thing that's critical, I've always felt and lived by this creed, is client service. Clients expect calls the same day. Clients expect you to be proactive if you have an idea that can help them. But even beyond that, once we had that, and that took a while to get, because I was alone in the audit department for several years. But once we had that, my nature, and I'm not sure where I got that from, but I like to grow things. So once I felt comfortable that we had a quality control system in place, my goal was to get out in the business community, meet as many bankers, lawyers, insurance folks, and attend, you know, join boards of directors, do speeches in the community or do whatever it took, you know, to grow the practice, which took a lot of work too.
And it sounds like that philosophy has really been a very durable philosophy, because from what I know about you and the firm's philosophy, it's unchanged, right? Quality and client service.
Yeah, I mean, we spent, for example, sometime in the last 2 years, we spent a lot of time, defining our core values, because if it's all about making money, it's not good. I mean, making money is critical, but you got to have core values. You got to believe in something. You got to believe in the things that we believe in. We believe in, number one, compassion for employees, compassion for our clients, making sure we give back to the business community. Like I said, making sure the quality has always got to be there, making sure that, you know, we're proactive with our clients. One of my famous comments to prospects and existing clients is, there's probably over 100,000 CPAs in the state of Texas. There's several good competitors out there, great competitors. And so, you know, we have to do something that they're not doing. We all say we have great client service, but we have to be proactive. We have to meet with them regularly, figure out what their needs are, how we can help them solve it, point out things that they may not know that could help them. And it's never an easy road. Different millennials, different generational type people that we hire, we spend a lot of time on culture, client service, soft skills training, technical skills. And I honestly believe that we still, to this day, have that same culture, the same core values, as large as we've become. And it's something that we believe in, we talk about in our board meetings, and we actually do.
That's awesome. And to give a context, you know, we talked about when you joined, there were about 9 people in 1982. And approximately how many total employees does the firm have now?
We have around 300 people now.
Wow, that is just amazing growth. Are you aware of any other firm in the state that has had that level of growth over that period of time? I can't think of one.
I don't know some of the firms. I know all the firms in Houston, I don't think, have had that type of growth. I can't say I know all the firms in the rest of Texas. But.
Okay. So I really appreciate the insight and kind of, you know, hearing the story of the audit practice from the very beginning. So what about from, like, when you started? So you talked about the 80s and you made partner in 89. You know, now let's get into the 90s. What were some of the significant events that happened in the 90s? Was that the year that, or was that the decade that the El Campo office was opened?
Yeah, the El Campo office, I think, was open in 89 or 99. But some of our growth, it's hard to, you know, to pinpoint, but I would say most of our growth, the majority of our growth through the years have been organic. And it's been based upon the things that, you know, Johnny stood for, our core values, the quality of work, fair prices, and trying to hire team players who live our culture, serve our clients, and, you know, do the timely service, treat our employees well. And also, in addition, as you said, David, we opened up our El Campo office, I believe, in 1999, had three to four small acquisitions prior to 2017. But through that period, it was a lot of internal growth. I sincerely believe if you treat your clients well, you're proactive, give them value for what they're paying, most importantly, treating your employees and training them, finding out what their passion is, that all of those factors together make you so valuable to the community and you know, they refer their friends. All our referral sources are happy with the services we provide their clients. So when you take all that together, I would say that in total is the most significant factor of our growth. Now, okay. After 2017, you know, from 2017 to current, we've done, you know, 5 additional major acquisitions. And, you know, those have all been none that we approached them first. We were approached by those companies. And we've always said that we wanted to be a Texas CPA firm. And to do that, we needed to be in the major Texas cities. We had every major international, national, and regional firm try to buy us out, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and we decided we wanted to be a legacy firm, and we decided that to do that, we needed to be in the major cities, so we had the heft and the resources to have all the technical resources we need, all the changes that are taking place in the CPA professional. We've all heard about the artificial intelligence, the robotics and everything that's going to change the audit and tax practices. And the IT area, and the computer and IT areas that you really need to be up on and spend the resources. So when we were looking for acquisitions or they came to us, geographic location was critical. I think you know that we have made 3 acquisitions in the Austin area in the last year and a half, 2 CPA firms and 1 valuation practice. We started our San Antonio CPA practice from scratch 2 years ago, and then we acquired a Woodland CPA firm, and also we acquired a Woodlands-based IT forensics company. So, again, we're looking for geographic location. The culture of these firms have to be right. Trying to mix a culture that doesn't have our core values would never work. We were looking for complementary or new niche areas that we didn't have. We were looking for strong young personnel that could be future partners. And then most importantly, to myself and our successor managing partner, Sheila Enriquez, we're looking for growing innovative firms with strong leadership. Because as we open up in other cities, we don't know the markets as well. So we're counting on the strong existing leadership to have the same core values we have, and to be innovative, to be growth oriented. And, fortunately for our firm, we've been very successful with all these acquisitions.
That is great. That is really an amazing acquisition spree over just a few years. So I'm curious, do what?
I hope it continues. But.
Sure. So I'm just curious, why was it important for the partners of the firm to remain a legacy firm? Because it seems like the easy thing to do would have been to have sold to a national or regional firm. What was the motivation or the underlying cultural decision that made you all make that decision to stay a legacy firm?
A great question. We received some tremendous offers that for some of the senior partners, such as myself, we could have retired a lot earlier. Monetarily, it was a great deal, less stress, less pressure. But our firm, we always make decisions for the best interest of the firm and all the partners. And many of our young partners, as we promoted them through the years, we promised them that we would be a legacy firm. They joined the firm. Many came from Big 8, Big 6, Big 4, regional firms or even local firms, and they wanted to be with a firm that one day they'd have leadership responsibilities. They'd have the same chance, for example, that I had to grow something, to grow a niche, to grow a department. And so when all these firms approached us and we spent probably 6 months with 9 or 10 of them, several days with each, we had all the entire partner group listen to their presentations and everything else. And then we decided after a few months that we needed to make a decision, legacy or sell out. We did PowerPoint presentations on the pros and cons. Some people call it SWOT analysis. And we held a vote. And, our senior partners were hoping that we'd remain a legacy firm, but we really weren't sure what the younger partners were thinking because it was one vote for one partner. And to our surprise and happiness, it was unanimous to stay a legacy firm. And all the partners in the discussion said they want a chance to build this firm. We think we could be top 100. Now we're thinking about a top 50 firm, but they want a chance to grow it, prove themselves. And, we were all happy with that decision. And the only caveat that we had going out of that meeting was we need to be in all the major Texas cities and grow enough to have the heft to keep up with technology, the robotics, the artificial intelligence, all the efficiencies that, and bring the right people in-house that we need to compete. Because I hear so many of our competitors that are smaller, several that were been surprised have approached us that, you know, they just can't, they don't have the resources, they're scared about the future, and, you know, we've worked real hard to make sure we have the best people in all areas, whether it's administration, audit, tax, consulting, and, you know, I think we all made the wise decision. We have a super group of young partners that can't wait to see how they're doing in the next 5 years. So.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember you told me probably more than a decade ago, because it, you know, we're both of us being in Houston, we're familiar with other firms in town, and it was, and it wasn't hard to notice that, you know, some other firms that, you know, 20 years ago were larger than Briggs & Vasalka, but grew at a much slower growth rate than Briggs & Vasalka. Now Briggs & Vasalka is, you know, larger, maybe even a multiple. But one of the things that you told me, one of the reasons the growth was so important was because you had these great young rising stars that if you didn't have growth, you would lose them, or you would make them have to wait for a spot to open up to make partner. And I always found that to be really interesting, especially when I've seen other firms that literally have told people, or that I've heard rumors to the effect that, yeah, you have everything it takes to make partner, but you need to wait till a partner retires till there's a slot. So could you just expand a little more on that? And first of all, is my recollection correct on that conversation?
Yeah, it's interesting. You hit the nail on the head, because I've always attributed our growth to a philosophy that when I took over as managing shareholder, you know, the tendency for most CPA firms and some of the established senior partners is, well, if we make a younger partner, we'll make less money. There's more ways to split the pot. I have never felt that way. I felt exactly what you just said, Dave. Number one, if you don't make young partners or young people that are qualified to be a partner, you're going to lose them. And secondly, if they're doing real well and you make them a partner, they're going to go out there, they're enthusiastic, they got more energy than someone like me, being a lot older. And so our philosophy has always been, since I was running the firm, that we're going to make as many partners as we can. And I don't want to mention names of firms, but I remember it was, I don't know, somewhere 8 or 10 years ago, we were about the same size as two of our competitors in the city of Houston. And now, like you said, we're, I don't know if we're twice their size or something, probably two or three times. I believe that the difference is, in that period of time, like it was an 8 or 10 year period, I think we made 10 or 11 new partners. And I don't know exactly, but I think in one of our competitors, they made zero partners. And the other one, I'm not really sure, but it couldn't have been more than one or two. And I have always said that I believe that especially the partners we made, I saw the results. Every year, our existing partners made more money. The younger partners, you know, after 2 or 3 years, they built their books up. It was as large as some of ours. And, you know, it's a way, number one, like you said, to keep your talent, because who would stick around to a firm that's never making partners? You know, they'd look around right. And say, well, I'm not going to waste my time here. And that's not always true, but generally is. And that was one of the philosophies. And I'll be honest with you, like I said earlier, I wasn't sure I was right, but it's something that I just believed in. And over the years, you know, it turned out to be right. And I just believe in people. And I think if you believe in the people and you give them that chance, 99% of the time, they're going to perform for you.
That is really a refreshing attitude. I appreciate your candor there. So, hey, just for the record, what year were you elected as managing partner, and how many years did you serve?
I believe it was in, and I may be 6 months or a year off, I think it was in 2009. And in that year, I think I had done a 2-year transition before that. with Johnny Veselka. Whenever you have a new managing shareholder, we go through a two-year transition. And I think I took over in 2009 officially after that 2 years. And then in July of 2018, last year, I stepped down and Sheila Enriquez is my successor at the firm.
Okay. So that's a long time to be leading the ship. And so if I'm just doing my simple math, you all had a lot of organic growth during that time with, some acquisitions near the end, right?
Oh yeah. Unfortunately for myself, I had some health problems last year. I think you're aware of, and the transition was supposed to last until October of 2019 this year. But after being in the hospital for a while, Sheila was temporarily running the firm, and I saw some great qualities in her. And, we were in the middle of several acquisitions. We had the hurricane, we had the new tax law, and several other things that were going on. And I guess I was so impressed. And my philosophy has always been, like I said earlier, that, if you have young talent and they're capable of doing a great job, the best thing you can do is promote them as quickly as you can. And based upon some of my health concerns and what I saw she did when I was out, it was quite obvious to me that for the future of this firm and the success of this firm, that she needed to be running it. And so called a board meeting when I got a little bit better and made it happen. So she's been running the firm since July of last year, 2018, and doing a great job, just a super job.
Yeah, she's an impressive individual. So just out of curiosity, what are some of the reasons that you believe that she was chosen as your successor, as the managing partner?
Interesting. Another great question. Dave, you knew Johnny Veselka personally. And,
sure.
And you knew the entire business community, all of us. Johnny Veselka had tremendous integrity. And, when you were around him, you knew he was honest, you knew he was integrity, you knew he was humble, smart as he was. And, so when I was thinking about who could be my successor, I was thinking of our executive committee members, and there were, I can't remember, four or five or six at the time. And I spent a lot of time thinking about who could really run this firm with the core values and have the qualities that I really think it needs in the future. And so after a lot of scratching on weekends, I came up with four things I was looking for. Number one, I needed someone that was growth oriented, innovative. Secondly, proactive in changing our firm from the compliance aspect to more of the consulting, the IT, the robotics, data analytics, IT, cyber risk assessments, and several of those things that we know are the future of the CPA profession. The compliance, the audit and tax will always be a core of our services. But the high margin areas are more in the consulting areas. And I needed someone that understood that was keeping current and all that. And then the last two that were even more important to me is, and this is so difficult with people being emotional and all that, is I needed someone that was fair and balanced to everyone. And for example, even if, Sheila or I do not like one particular partner for their personality, but they lived their core values, they did a great job for the firm, they were a team player, you need to respect them and be fair to them. And not everybody can do that, but she could. And the final one was no ego, team player, and to be humble. And, and I felt like of all the people I was considering, she was the only one that had that. Now, I could tell you all the other qualities she had, as you've probably seen, she's very eloquent. People just love being around her just like they did Johnny. But these four were the four things that I thought were important to our firm at that point in time. And she had all those qualities. So,
yeah. So let me make sure that I, are you still there, John?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I heard a beep and wasn't sure. So the four things you were looking for: growth oriented, proactive in leading the firm through through an evolution due to technological change. The third being fair and balanced, and then the fourth being someone with no ego and a team player and with humility. Was that, did I capture that?
Yep. Got it.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I would say from my experience of spending time with Sheila, I would certainly agree. And interestingly enough on that, I'd noticed recently that the managing partners of all of the big four firms in Houston all have female managing partners. And so this isn't really something I've paid attention to. I just happened to notice it. Is this a trend that's been going on for a while? And if so, do you have any thoughts on why that is? Because it just seems interesting when for so long, there were no female managing partners, and then suddenly all the firms have female partners. And I know I'm kind of asking your opinion here.
Yeah, I mean, this is just an opinion. This is not based upon any facts, but, it is true in the last few years that the remaining big four accounting firms and even some of the regional firms all have seem to have female managing partners. I mean, the obvious reason is, and I don't know how many years, but maybe the last 10, 12 years, the majority of accounting graduates have been from women, not men. If you go to, University of Houston-Bauer, I don't know, 60 or 70% of accounting graduates in the last several years have been women. So eventually, the numbers are more favoring them to rise up to become partners, managing partners.
Interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
But still, I still think in some of the local firms, although the trend's changing to a lot of female managing partners, but, it's a little different than the national firms. I still think there's a lot of, men managing partners still. And that may be because some of them are hanging on into their 70s and some in their 80s, believe it or not. But, hopefully that'll kind of get balanced out in the future.
Sure. Okay. Well, thanks for that. What would you say? There's a couple questions I want to ask, but I'm also sensitive to our time. What's one unique thing about the firm that most people outside the firm are not aware of, if anything that comes to mind?
Something unique about our firm.
That maybe isn't just super, well known.
Yeah. I would say, although I don't know if this is the case at other firms, but at our firm, one of the things that surprised me actually in the last 5 years is we're an extremely diverse firm in terms of our personnel. Just like Houston is one of the most diverse cities in the country as far as, people. I've learned that we speak over 20 different languages. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know how many countries we have represented here. And it was kind of a surprise to me because, if I go back more than 10 years ago, I would never have imagined that, but looking, I was talking to our business development manager about a year or two ago, and he said we speak over 18 different languages. I don't know how many, 20 or some countries we have people here. And it's really helped because, whether it's Hispanic, we have, I think, 3 or 4 Mandarin speaking partners. When a lot of the business community, is as diverse as it is, when they have people that they can trust and be comfortable with that are, their same culture and everything, it really helps. And I don't know how many opportunities I've had where, one of them asked me, well, do you speak Japanese, John? And I said, nope, not even close. But it really helps in the relationships. And that, I guess that's, and again, I don't know if we're unique in that, but I thought that was unique about our firm.
I would sense that is unique. I know we actually share a client that's owned by Chinese people, and the and the tax partner for that engagement is one of your tax partners who, you know, speaks Chinese. And I remember, because they were a client of ours before they became a client of Briggs & Vasselka, and I didn't even know they were looking for a new firm. But when they announced that they had selected you all, it made perfect sense because of your partner, Shen Shen. And so I can imagine where, you know, that cultural connection they have, and the fact that this, you know, company is, you know, active in China. And I can see where that can be a real asset, because I can imagine some of the other firms in your space. I wouldn't be surprised if none of them had any Chinese speaking partners.
We also have, interesting, in the Asian community, we actually have one of our audit shareholders is fluent in Mandarin. And of course, Shen, as you mentioned, and Forrest, another tax partner, both also fluent in Mandarin. So we have a large Asian practice also because of them primarily.
Sure, sure. No, that makes sense. So I'd like to shift gears now and talk about, the Briggs & Vasselka philosophy of referring clients to service providers other than Briggs & Vasselka. You know, the firm has always had a reputation of making introductions to banks and other service providers that, you know, perform services that the firm does not. And, and I assume that the firm, you know, historically has not been compensated for such referrals. So with that in mind, you know, why do you and your partners invest the time to make these introductions when there's no benefit to the firm financially?
You know, one of our core values that I always keep referring back to is to make sure we provide high quality, you know, hopefully proactive and effective service to our clients. And to be honest, we do not always have the resources or capabilities, you know, to help our clients in all these things that can benefit them. So we spend a lot of time looking for high quality service providers, most of the time in Houston, you know, that can help them save, for example, save taxes, better loan terms, other valuable and necessary services that our clients need and expect from us. And as you well know, we don't have the capability, and we don't do IC disk or some of the things that you do, and, you know, the cost segregation that others do, or R&D or some of these other things. So we, you know, vet pretty hard these outside vendors who can help our clients. And it's not about, you know, us always getting the money. It's about making sure our clients get the best possible help they can to do what they need to do, or save money, or structure better. And so a lot of times we have to look for outside service providers, and, you know, we've done well over the years to make sure that whoever we're recommending to our clients are high quality people. They have the same core values we do, great client service, and they know what they're doing. So It just seems like a natural thing to do.
So it sounds like, when I flip back, yeah, would you believe I already have four pages of notes? When I flip back to, or look back to the first page, when you talked about the philosophy back in 82 of quality and client service. So it really sounds like what we're talking about here is just a subset of the client service. It just sounds like it's just a natural part of the client service. Is that right?
No, that's exactly right.
Okay. So how do you decide when to bring a service in-house, either organically or through acquisition? Is it just when you get to the point that, you know, you've referred out, you know, 100 projects for a certain area that you think, well, geez, you know, maybe with that level of volume, you know, maybe it would make sense to develop that in-house, or would it be like a specific client request, or what kind of goes into that thought process?
Dave, I think that's part of it, like you said, where, you know, you're outsourcing so much revenue that you think, okay, you know, we can do this and we can keep the revenue in-house. But I think that another more important part, at least the way we think here is, are the people that we're outsourcing the services to, are they providing the same high quality service, the same responsiveness to our clients that we would expect? And what we've traditionally and historically done is, when the outside service providers are, we see no need for us to get into that area because our clients are being served. They know we recommended a quality person, so it's okay. But it's interesting that you bring that up because in the last 2 years, one of those situations happened. We, and you know, obviously I'm not going to mention any names or anything, but
we were
referring tons of work on what they call the SALT cases, sales and use tax, because we didn't really have the expertise in-house. You know, every state in this country, every municipality, they all have different rules and regs. And so whenever we had a situation where the state was auditing one of our clients, or clients would call us and say, hey, do I need to pay sales tax on this? And all this was before the Wayfair decision that happened recently. But, you know, so we referred it out. We started getting comments from our clients in the last couple of years, you know, various partners, who brought it to my attention and saying, hey, they're not responsive. It's been 6 months. What's going on? And, you know, so it got to a point where we had a board meeting and, you know, we started saying, hey, do we need to find someone from the outside to start an in-house practice? And we did. You know, it wasn't, yes, we were giving up a lot of revenue, but the real impetus of this was the lack of quality service that the various outside vendors that we were sending to our clients just wasn't working. Service wasn't there, too many complaints. And so, and that was our SALT practice. We, again, I don't know, somebody's looking out for our firm, but a gentleman named John Cooney, who headed up PricewaterhouseCoopers's SALT practice in the Houston office, he had just retired. I think they make their partners retire like in their late 50s or something like that. And one of our partners had met him at some function or somewhere, and you know, the conversation developed. He was and still is at his peak, and you know, we got him in house, and you know, it's just been wonderful. No complaints in the first year alone. It's on our intranet. He saved our clients over $25 million in sales tax savings.
Wow!
And that combination of, you know, during sales tax audits, inform our clients, no, you don't need to pay sales tax on that. You know, it's a cumulative type number, and that was within 1 year. I haven't seen what he's, you know, he's been here a little over 2 years. So, but more important than all that is, you know we have someone that cares about our clients, that's giving quality service. We've got no complaints, and not only has he done that, but our clients are talking to other companies in town, and he's going out and helping them. And what I've learned, because he's been in front of some of my clients, I used to think sales and use tax is a pretty simple thing, and it's so complicated. Each industry has different rules, and it seemed like it would take a lifetime of learning to know all that. And he's done such a wonderful job. And, you know, as an example with that Wayfair Supreme Court decision, which basically, and I'm not an expert on this, but basically said, you know, for many years, if you didn't have a physical presence in another state, you didn't have to pay sales tax and you didn't have to file all the forms. But everybody complained about online internet sales, and those were exempt. The Wayfair decision said no longer. So each state is coming up with rules to say, hey, if you do a certain amount of internet dollars online, we're going to tax you. And so he's been in high demand lately, because you don't want clients to suddenly after 2 or 3 years get these huge bills, or if they're trying to sell their company, it's dug up in due diligence. So, you know, John's been just a super asset to this firm. His client service and quality are exceptional. And, you know, again, that was a case where we brought someone in-house for the first reason you said, because we were sending literally tons of money that we could have had. But more importantly, we kept getting complaints. And, you know, now it's another area we don't have to worry about. It's a growing area of the firm. And there have been others through the years, like international tax, but those are the reasons that we would take it in-house.
So I think there's a great learning lesson there. So that I think all of us in the service business can take notice of, and that is that you had either one or a collection of salt firms that you were referring business to, and here you are a rapidly growing firm, which I would assume would mean the referrals you're sending them are growing, the number of referrals you're sending them are growing, and they had this golden goose that was just automatically growing, that all they had to do to keep it going was just to feed the goose and take care of the goose. And apparently, for whatever reason, they took their eye off the ball and the goose flew away. So I guess it's just a reminder to never get complacent in, serving both clients and your, centers of influence for new clients.
Yeah, that's true. And, that applies to us too. I always try to remind our managers and seniors and actually fellow partners that, we're only as good as our last job. You got to keep up with all the technical standards, be in front of your clients all the time, make sure that they're getting their needs answered and solved. And, it's a constant, you're in this, like us, we're all in the service business and we need to do it. And you cannot ever become complacent.
Sure, sure. Well, wow, I can't believe how fast the time has flown. We're already 50 minutes in. Let's see. So you mentioned you've got offices in Houston, El Campo, The Woodlands, San Antonio, and Austin. And you'd mentioned you want to be in all the major cities. So that would imply that the Metroplex, Dallas, Fort Worth, is on your radar screen. I'm not going to ask any specific questions as far as, things you're considering doing, but is it fair to say that you expect to have an office in the Metroplex at some point?
That's correct.
Okay. So you talked about that I think the HBJ article with Sheila, she was talking about that the firm was nearly, in the top 100. And then you'd mentioned that you've now kind of, set new goals of trying to be in the top 50 at some point. If we were guessing like 5 years from now, how large do you think the firm might be? Or maybe, give me what are your thoughts there? If you had 600 people 5 years from now, would that surprise you? Maybe that'd be a better way to phrase it. If the firm was twice as big 5 years from now, would that surprise you?
Actually, no. I mean, we update our strategic plan every year. We have an internal organic growth percentage, and we've always exceeded whatever our plan is. Plus, we have an acquisition strategy. And both Johnny, myself, and Sheila are eternal optimists, by the way. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, I've observed that.
I believe that based on our past organic growth, the expected future growth, expected acquisitions, and more important to me, and the super leadership team that we have assembled, I can say their names, Sheila is our managing partner, Jason Sanders is our tax department chair, Adam Dimmick is our audit department chair. I'm really excited about that leadership team. It's, at least compared to me, it's young, it's smart, it's technical, it's innovative, and I see a firm in the next, 5 to 10 years at least doubling in size. If, I believe we'll be bigger than that, but a lot of it depends on what acquisitions you do. There's a lot of factors that you can't control, but yeah, it would not surprise me at all.
Wow, that is great. And speaking of your partners, so how many partners does the firm have now? Or shareholders, I guess, technically?
I'm going to say approximately, so I don't get killed on this one. I think around 32 or 33.
Wow, that is really, that's really impressive for how, because your partner growth has occurred along with your employee growth. So... you know, one of the questions I had that you answered already was, you know, as the firm has grown, what are some of the things that have not changed? And I think you'd mentioned that, the commitment to quality and in client service. Is there anything that we didn't cover today that you think we should have talked about or that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, one of the other things that I must add, I think I mentioned it briefly answering another question, but would like to emphasize, you've got to believe in your people, and you've got to, it's a different era than it was 10 or 15 years ago. You've got to make sure that you offer the best training, the best opportunities. You got to figure out what each individual's passion is. You just don't put X number of people in audit, tax, and consulting. Each person's unique. They have unique talents. We spend a lot of time trying to figure out where their passion is, where they can help the firm the most, benefit themselves the most. And that's sort of on the technical side. On the people side, we want to make sure that, just like I get up every morning and I love coming to work after almost 40 years here, we want to make sure that all of our people, it's an environment where they feel they can speak up, their ideas are listened to, but it's also a fun place. And to that end, one of the things I think Johnny and myself and Sheila are most proud of is we've gotten best places to work either from the HBJ or the Chronicle. I think we're going on years 13 or 14 now. But we do a lot of things. We do a lot of employee activities. We spend several days out, all of our employees, out in the community. We pick like 10 or 11 charities in the community. Groups go out to those charities and volunteer for an entire day. And that's important to a lot of our people. As an example, I'm a dog lover, so I go to bark and let the dogs out of their cages and walk them. But whatever that's the passion, the person, and I know you are too, Dave, but whatever, you know, so the community, charity, making sure it's fun. We have a lot of outings and we do a lot of fun things at the firm and we offer all those. So I think, you know, that I've just seen it work through the years. I've seen people do things like, for me as a partner, come to my house, drive 50 miles on a Sunday to drop off something so I don't have to. And, you know, keeping your people happy, challenged, I think it's so important to the success. And I believe that we make that effort and it really helps the firm grow. So
I want to emphasize. That is great. No, I'm really glad that you did, John, because it's really clear that you have a commitment to the firm and your clients. And I mean, you've always had a reputation as having tremendous client and employee commitment. And it's just really great to kind of hear it right from your mouth, your thoughts on this and your passion and conviction on the type of culture that you've tried to build and hope continues even after you retire is just really clear that it's just really that it's really heartfelt and genuine.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I have to say I love the firm. I care about the firm. You know, I also care about the profession, you know, and the profession took some hits, you know, in the public eye over the years. So, you know, quality is important. You know, like I said, giving back to the community charity-wise, giving back to the profession. You know, many of our CPAs are very active in the Houston CPA chapter, the Texas Society of CPAs, and, you know, it's all about giving back because it's been great to our firm, this city, and this community. So, and I wanted to plug in that office? You know, I've known Dave for, gosh, I don't know, over 20 years, more than that maybe. And, you know, Dave's one of our service providers that we don't feel like we need to do anything in-house because Dave was with us for a short while, but, you know, he's one of these outside service folks that does a great job of quality, timely service. I know in the past I could call him up no matter what hour, I say, hey, my client needs this, and he's on it. So I'd like to put a plug in for your business, too. So.
Well, John, that was very kind of you. You didn't need to do that. But in all fairness, almost everything I know about client service, I've learned from you. So if you're happy with the way we treat your clients, it's because I learned it from you. So thank you for showing me how to do that. Well, John, I really appreciate your time today. I know you're busy. And I do want to could you share your contact info? The phone number is the main number, 713-667-9147. Is that right?
Correct. That's correct.
And your email address is?
It's jflatowicz, FLATOWICZ, the @ symbol, V as in boy, V as in Victor, C as in candy, CPA.com.
Okay. And so if somebody just wants to reach out to you, you know, directly, just say hi, they can do that. Sure. But what about if somebody is, if somebody's interested in, exploring a relationship with your firm, somebody that owns a business that's looking to change CPA firms, would you rather they reach out to Sheila or would it make sense for them to reach out to you? What would you prefer?
I mean, either way is fine. If one of us is always here in the firm, so they can call me, they can call Sheila. We also have a business development gentleman named Bill Pensack. They can call in any one of us three, and we'll make sure we get them to the right people. It may not be me. It may not be Sheila. It may be whoever has the expertise and the industry experience to help those people.
Great. Well, that sounds awesome. Well, John, thank you again for your time and best of luck in the continued growth of the firm.
Thank you so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
There we have it. Another great episode. Thanks for listening in. If you want to continue the conversation, go to icdiscshow.com. That's icdiscshow.com. And we have additional information on the podcast, archived episodes, as well as a button to be a guest. So if you'd like to be a guest, go select that and fill out the information, and we'd love to have you on the show. So that's it. We'll be back next time with another episode of the IC Disc Show.